Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill, we're with you.
Yes, with
my tongue is 3 seconds behind. But
you're excited for spring, aren't you?
My presence is always here.
I'm excited for spring.
I am too.
Mm. So, what two better topics to address in the spring than dogwoods and redbuds and potting soil? We've talked about soil a great deal, actually. This season so far in different forms and fashions.
Right.
But today we're going to talk about potting soil, how to provide your container plants really with the best, you know, possible environment that you can.
Much more important than people realize.
It really is.
I've learned some bitter lessons in this and by using bad soil or the wrong soil or soil that wasn't properly draining. And the plants let you know within a few months.
Yeah, they do.
As I always say, death is nature's way of telling you.
You did something wrong.
You did something wrong with your potting soil.
All right. Yeah, Shelley Nold's going to join us today to talk about that. Shelley's the owner of the Plant Kingdom with her husband, Tony Nold. And Shelley's kind of known around these parts for doing really fabulous containers. So surely she knows how to mix the soil accordingly. So we look forward to that. And then Dr. Paul Capiello of UDEL fame, of course, to talk about dogwoods and redbuds.
Yeah, Paul actually wrote the book.
He did write a book on dogwoods.
Along with Don Shadow, the Tennessee legend on dogwoods. And he knows a lot about redbuds among just about every other plant.
Yeah, he does.
Known to the human race. So he'll be fun to talk to. Of course, we'll talk about UDEL a little bit and how they're doing and how the storm affected them. And then we'll move right on to spring and dogwoods and redbuds.
Sounds good. So that's coming up on Homegrown. We hope that you'll stick with us. Meanwhile, Bob, what is going on in your spring about to burst garden?
Well, actually, just in time for Shelley to show up, I've been repotting some of our old plants because we forget to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I brought plants in last fall, put them in the little room off the kitchen.
Which like houseplant, tropical plant things.
Yeah, all those things. Mm-hmm. And the dirt just needs to be repotted. Mm-hmm. You got to shake them out and start over again with some of these plants. So I'm doing that, which is something we forget to do in the spring.
And
March
is a good time, perfect time to do it.
The other thing equally important is I've been walking around the yard taking a second look at some of the damage. We picked up all the limbs and the trees, and I thought we made all the cuts clean and we did the best we could. But I noticed over the weekend that there's a lot of broken limbs up there I couldn't get to, or there's damage on the backside of a tree where the whole limb fell off.
Kind of like ripped down the side.
Yep, and I'm debating whether to wait another year and or take it down or what to do with it. Anyway, just walking around the yard, reassessing the damage from the storm.
And I think that that's something that we're going to have to continue to do, as you said, you know, wait another year. But this is something we're going to have to continue to do every couple of months.
Absolutely.
Because things can start and progress. And, you know, if rot starts to begin and decay begins, you know, that's something that won't become apparent for another couple of months or 6 months or a year. So we really do need to keep our eye on those
things. And there'll be some more windy storms this spring. And then the stuff that was weakened and stayed up. May decide to call it quits.
Yeah.
And so I'm just kind of looking around and evaluating things.
Yeah, as everybody should continue.
How about
to
the Wishy Estate? What's up?
Well, we've been doing that too still. It's like I feel like every week I can say, well, we're still hauling debris and staging for the chipper to show up because the chipper is supposed to come this week. So we really got on it this weekend. But honestly, what some of the stuff I'm refocusing, changing, you know, direction, weed control measures, kind of assessing that whole issue.
Right.
The cool season weeds like chickweed and the henbit stuff, that's all already starting to grow, of course.
I know.
So get that pulled and weed it out before it flowers and goes to seed, you know, which will perpetuate that whole cycle. Putting mulch down, now's a good time to go ahead and get some mulch down. The soil's warmed up and, you know, a little bit, so things will moderate. You can use pre-emergent weed controls if you want. You can use conventional ones that are, you know, chemical-based, or you can use my favorite, the corn gluten pre-emergent that's a more natural that helps offset the germination of pesky weeds. So, you know, get on that stuff right now before it becomes a problem. And, I mean, honestly, you've noticed this in areas too, haven't you, Bob, where areas that you're more diligent about these things, you really do, over the course of a couple of years, get a handle on weed problems. But if you let it go and the whole reseeding thing, you shoot yourself in the foot.
And speaking of spring bloomers, there's an event coming up at UDEL.
There is, which is, you know, a festivity honoring what we might even consider a winter bloomer or a late winter bloomer, but it's the Hellebore Days, and it's going to take place out at UDEL on March 28th from noon to 3 p.m. They've got a fabulous collection there at UDEL. Plus, you know, other interesting late winter blooming plants like witch hazels, some of the little crocus, minor bulbs, etc. So you can check out our website at wfpl.org for a little bit more information on that. And of course, we will be talking to Paul Capiello from UDale in the second part of the show. So stick around. For now, though, Bob, we're going to talk about potting soil so you can get a good primer on potting soil before you pot up all those plants that have, that are in your hot tub room.
I am ready.
All right. Joining us in the studio is Shelley Nold. Shelley is a horticulturist and the owner of the Plant Kingdom, a garden center in St. Matthews. One of Shelley's acquired skills over the years is creatively putting together, designing containers. She has an eye for that detail, but a plant in a container is only as good as the soil that we provide it. So, Shelley, we're looking for some insight. Welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Listen, store-bought potting soil, I've always felt like it wasn't quite right just to buy a bag of potting soil and just exclusively use that in my containers. What is just the basic stuff made up of?
The basic potting soil is mainly sphagnum peat moss, which mm-hmm. is the component and the majority of potting soils that you would purchase. You're looking for a high quality, light, soilless potting media, and that's essentially what you get. Most of the time, there's also going to be vermiculite or perlite, and mm-hmm. it's going to have a wetting agent to help the soil to receive water and to become moist, because it's very repellent when it's very dry.
Yeah, I've noticed that. It kind of seems like it just runs off unless you really soak it
good.
Yeah.
It can be very dusty, you know, uh-huh. and so the wetting agent helps it receive the water.
So typically that sort of potting soil is good for, you know, for your nursery, the stuff that's potted up for sale. But what about using that in the containers that we're creating at home that have to sort of survive in a different way?
Well, we consider that the first starting point to have that particular type of soil. Uh-huh. And then you can add things to it as you need along the way. And that's dependent on the crop that you're growing, the situation that it's in. Mm-hmm. And needs for every particular type of plant are going to vary. And so knowing what you want to grow and how much you want it to grow is important. The container garden is a false growing environment. So we have to provide everything to it that it needs to grow. And the starting point is the soil for the root system, which is the basis for all growth.
Well, Shelley, as a general rule, you get what you pay for in potting soil. You go into some of these big box stores and there'll be four different kinds, different prices. Are you better off basically paying the higher price for what you get, or is it, how do you know what to get?
Basically, yes. And that's because there are all different levels of peat moss, mm-hmm. and the highest being the Canadian sphagnum peat moss. And that is ideally what we want to use. And then there are lower levels, which are essentially the same product, but in a more decomposed state. Okay. And so the value of them is diminishing as far as the plant is concerned. So that is true.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so different types of things that we can add to the basic potting soil, depending on, let's set up a couple of scenarios. Let's say we're going to use some succulents. How do we improve the soil and make it ideal for succulents? And then we'll take a look at, you know, some more traditional sorts of plantings that may require a little more moisture.
For succulents, even in cacti, which are incredibly popular right now.
They're very popular. I love them.
And they're super low maintenance, so we encourage everybody to grow them. But you want to actually change the soil the most for that particular crop.
Okay.
And so what we would do is we would switch actually to perlite, which is a volcanic, you know, it comes from a volcanic substance and holds moisture, but doesn't hold as much moisture as vermiculite. So we would want to switch to that if we could.
So that's the distinction between the perlite and vermiculite. Vermiculite holds more water, perlite holds less.
Different sources of origin and a little bit different water holding capacity, but it's not a lot. And then we also would want to add in an additional rocky substrate, something like permatil, which actually looks just like gravel, but is meant for use in growing media and potting soils. And what we're providing is a much drier environment, but that will also hold moisture as similar to what like a sandy soil would, but not having the use of sand, which mm-hmm. we don't like to use.
Okay. So optimizing drainage and all that, keeping it a little drier, that's not ideal for a lot of containers that people, you know, especially around here, you know, maybe with some tropicals or, you know, your typical annuals that are going to require a lot more moisture. And you had pointed out, too, it's a kind of a false growing environment, so we've got to provide them with everything that they need. So how do we optimize everything that the plant needs with mixing a concoction, if you will,
for
traditional annuals.
The good thing about the sphagnum peat moss is that it doesn't really come in with any nutrient value to it whatsoever. So we can pick and choose exactly how we want to manipulate it. Mm-hmm. And so nutrients are the most important thing, in my opinion, to start thinking about. But they have to be kind of continually applied or given to the plant throughout the growing season. So that's why we start with the peat moss. And also, the larger container that you choose, the more rooting volume that you have, the lower maintenance it is. But the thing that I like to use to add nutrients to the soil and add a little weight to the soil, because the peat moss is very light, is worm castings or a very good high quality compost, whatever type of compost you may have of your own that you have prepared, or you can purchase that. And what that does is add a little substance, if you think, to the soil for the root system to grow in and to absorb nutrients from.
Well, and won't it like stay a little more moist too if
it
you
will.
Add that kind of material?
It will stay a little bit more moist. The peat moss is has the capacity to either be an incredibly dry environment or an incredibly wet environment, whichever you choose it to be. Mm-hmm. And we adapt that for the plant material. You could find some potting soils have water polymers in them, which are very popular. And what that does is actually absorb an unusual amount of water that then is there available for the plant material as time elapses. The container environment is a high maintenance environment anyway, so that is beneficial.
Okay, so do you recommend getting those little they're like, it's kind of like little pieces of Jello, right?
Right.
So
I like to have them already coming in the soil and not adding them separately, only because we tend to put in way too much. And then you have an eruption of soil coming out of your containers because there's so
Once
much
it puffs
water.
Up.
Right. So I like to use the ones that already have that in there, mixed in with them.
Okay, Shelley, I grew geraniums, verbena in my pots last year. Can I use that dirt again, just kind of refreshing it, or would you recommend getting all new dirt and changing out the plants to something else?
Use the soil again. There's nothing wrong with it. And the thing that you will remove some of it by removing that dead plant material from the season before. So usually we just stir it up and then we add new as necessary to fill the container with the plants. All the qualities are still there, and so don't waste it. Just go ahead and use it again. Mm-hmm. We do have clients that require that we dump all the soil out and we just compost it, and then it goes back into use again. And that's for storage purposes. So if you need to do that for storage, that's understandable. But if you don't have to, then save it and use it again.
And what do you put in the bottom of the container to facilitate the drainage? Gravel or cracked pottery, or what do you use?
There's kind of a wide thought process on this. I prefer to use as much of the volume of the container for rooting purposes. So unless I need to put something in the bottom for weight, to prevent the container from falling over or to prevent it from walking off, perhaps by death, then I just use pine bark mulch. You can even use a couple layers of old t-shirt or burlap just to line the drainage hole to keep a bunch of gunk from coming out of the bottom or staining your patio. That's all that's really necessary. Using rock or brick chips is not necessary unless you need added weight.
Okay. And honestly, the more soil there is, the more rooting, the more moisture, the more nutrition, so the better off the plant. So what about we touched on nutrition a little bit, fertilization and all that. Do you have a preference over using something like Osmocote, which is the slow release little pellets mixed into the soil, or do you prefer a water soluble, more controlled at certain times in terms of fertilization?
I actually use both. I do like to use Osmocote in the beginning as the plants are just getting started, but it's not enough because any slow-release fertilizer, when heat and water affect it, is going to disperse and the nitrogen is all going to go away, essentially. Mm-hmm. So we have a long growing season and we need to continue to fertilize at least once a month, if not twice a month, our container plantings. And so a soluble fertilizer is really the best.
As a general product, would you use like 10-10-10, 18-12-10, or what do you recommend?
Well, the general rule for solubles is a 20-20-20. Okay. And if you want actually less, just actually mix up less in your container. You can turn it into a 10-10-10. Or if you need a little bit more, if you have a crop that requires more nitrogen, you could actually bump it up a little bit. But I do prefer those over the atypical bag of 10, 10, 10. The problem with those is that to me, the carrier of those fertilizers sits on the soil surface and exposes itself, and one, looks unattractive, and two, could be, you know, picked up by birds or children or whatever the case might be. So we prefer it to be invisible once it's applied. It's a little safer that way.
Mm-hmm. So Shelley, I've got quite a few tropicals that I drag back inside during the winter months. So these are not containers that, you know, are refreshed every year, if you will. Are there any considerations, extra considerations, you know, in maintaining those pots? People often ask, too, just about their houseplants and the soil or, like, the gnats that come out of them or, you know, how often they need to repot. Are there certain considerations that are a little bit different than what we've discussed if you know that a plant's going to sit in a pot for a couple of years as opposed to just one season?
Only subtle differences, you know, as far as that goes. And it's really crop dependent. If an issue comes up like fungus gnats, we can deal with it at that time. Mm-hmm. And because it's a false growing environment, and atypically your houseplants or your tropical plants, you have them or want to have them for a long amount of time, you don't want to keep every 2 years bumping them up in size, or they become impossible to move in and out because of the weight. Mm-hmm. So we can actually remove them from their original pot and do some root pruning, a little washing off of the soil, and actually put them back in the same pot refreshed, and that is very healthy for the plant and keeps it from
getting a monster.
A giant, yeah, ficus.
That's a really good idea, actually. Shelley, thank you. Some really good tips at getting our container plants started and doing well throughout the season. We appreciate your time. Thanks for coming in.
Uh-huh.
Shelley Nold has a degree in horticulture from the University of Kentucky. She's worked as an extension agent in the state and owns and operates the Plant Kingdom, a full-service family-run garden center in St. Matthews. For more information on potting soil and everything else we've talked about today, please see our website at wfpl.org.
After the break, UDEL's Paul Capiello on dogwoods and redbuds for Kentuckiana. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Janine Wishy.
Live with Bob Hill.
Yes, indeed.
This is fun being on your own show. It is.
You're so easily entertained, Bob.
I've been told that, yeah.
Yeah, we are here in the studio because it's the spring drive, and it's time to raise our, you know, 6 months of money. $170,000 is needed to keep WFPL going strong. This hour, our goal was $3,000.
We're going to do it.
And we've already, I think, in the first 25 minutes, at least knocked out about 700 of that.
We are worthy. We are worthy of this.
We are, and thank you so much. It's, you know, reaffirmation that Homegrown is a show that you like in Louisville. And if you do listen to it, and if you're one of those people that's starting to garden for the very first time, give us a call at 502-814-6565. Become a member, a renewing member, a repeat giver, anything. We'll take it. But we're doing a pretty good job so far. But we'd love to hear from you. 502-814-6565 or go online at WFPL.org.
And there's so many great ways to give. Last year, my wife, I'm worth a dollar a day to my wife, apparently,
well, that's
which
good.
Sort of amazed me. A day sponsorship, you just put a dollar a day is all it is, on your birthday or a special event, six times during the day.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody on the station will say, "Hey, Bob, your wife loves you."
Yeah.
In so many words.
Mm-hmm.
And people listen to that. They stop me in the street and said, "Hey, happy birthday."
That's sweet.
So it's fun.
That's super
imagine
nice.
Life without public radio. I can't imagine.
Especially now. So, yes, if you certainly can't imagine life without public radio, give us a call, 502-814-6565. Show your support. You can go online. It's safe and secure, of course, WFPL.org. And we've got a couple of people to thank, Andy and Gwen McMahon. They listen all the time. Thank you very much. Celia Lawrence, her favorites are The Splendid Table, Homegrown. Thank you, Celia. Sunday Morning Quizmaster. That's a pretty good one, too. Keeps your mind sharp, I think. And that's one of the things that I think public radio can bring to you. So if you want to keep your mind sharp, whether it's gardening or food or, you know, any of the other programs that we offer, give us a call, 502-814-6565. Show your support. And let's see. Thanks to Susan Stribel. FPL is the station she listens to. She supports public radio and says thank you. And thank you, everybody, for supporting public radio.
And I've got Kai Lee, a renewing member, says she loves Homegrown.
Thank you.
Everybody knows home is best.
Oh, that's sweet.
She's right.
She is right.
And then there's Bess and Kevin White, more renewing members. Glad to have them.
Absolutely.
Just keep them.
Keep them coming,
cards,
folks.
And letters coming in.
Our goal this hour is $3,000. We have $2,292 left to raise. So we're doing a pretty good job, but you know, we want to reach that goal. We want to say that yes, Homegrown is supported in the community. Show us your support by calling 502-814-6565. It'll help support our program, but also all the other programs that are offered on WFPL. And as Bob said, I know that I can't live without it. We want to also thank Whole Foods for lunch. And the First Unitarian Church and Seven County Services for answering the phones. Those folks are back there working hard. Keep them working hard. Call us at 502-814-6565. You know, it's the spring drive.
And speaking of great shows, I was driving home last night, and I always have public radio on, and it was this wonderful show about this group of people that are photographing the icebergs and the glaciers that are disappearing.
Uh-huh.
And they set these cameras up in 30 remote places around the world. And they take a picture every hour for a long period of time, and you can just see the glaciers backing up. You don't find that kind of stuff anywhere else except public radio.
You don't. We need you. You need us. We need you. Show your support. Help us raise that $170,000 that we need this time around. And the $3,000 that Bob and I need this hour to keep Homegrown strong as well. 814-6565 is the number to call. There's a bunch of people back there working. A bunch of people, actually, back there answering the phone. So that's a good sign. But we do definitely want to hear from you. We want to thank you as well.
It's our sixth year now for Homegrown?
Huh?
It's about our sixth year, I think, for Homegrown.
I think so, yeah, absolutely.
It's been a lot of fun. We, you know, people wonder how we get ideas. We just get together and plan them and find them and put them on air.
Yep. And if you call us today, you will be registered to win a $750 gift card from Rainbow Blossom Natural Food Markets, which I think fits beautifully with Homegrown as we try to teach everybody about how to garden well, whether it's food or ornamental. So give us a call, 814-6565. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And I think everybody agrees that dogwoods and rosebuds are...
How about redbuds?
Oh, rose. Did I say rosebuds?
You said rosebuds.
Redbuds.
Janine's drugs wearing off there.
Dogwoods and redbuds say spring more than anything else in Kentuckiana.
Absolutely. And we've got the perfect man to talk about
that. We do indeed.
Dr. Paul Capiello is Executive Director of UDEL Gardens in Crestwood, Kentucky, co-author of the book Dogwoods, written with Tennessee horticultural legend Don Shadow, and has traveled the country and the world seeking the very best plants, including redbuds and dogwoods. Paul, welcome to Homegrown.
Nice to be here.
Let's catch up on UDEL first. How'd you guys make out in the recent storms?
How many 100,000 cubic yards of brush have we hauled through the garden and the arboretum?
Yeah.
We've done the majority of the cleanup, but we've still, we probably have another month or two before we get everything cleaned up. We were lucky. We didn't lose too many whole trees. We just lost lots of parts of a lot of trees. So nothing really hugely critical hit the ground, but it'll just be a lot of cleanup and a lot of planting opportunities.
Right. That's what we keep stressing to ourselves as well. Opportunity. Yeah. Well, that's good to hear.
And of course, there's a lot of dogwoods out there too. We know that. Let's talk first about the dogwoods in general and even the flower itself. People confuse flowers and bracts and all that kind of thing. So tell us about the dogwood in general.
The best way to win a beer at the neighborhood barbecue. What color are your dogwood flowers? Of course, they're green or yellow, generally, and not white. Those are just the protective bracts that that inflate over the spring, and that's what gives us the huge display. But, you know, dogwoods have had it, they've sort of taken it on the chin recently. In recent years, some of the diseases that have hit them have just really made it tough on them. But there's some great new varieties out there, some that have been on the market for a while that have really, really improved what we can do with dogwoods.
Well, Paul, can we sort of make some distinctions, too? Because I think the dogwoods that we have available to us in the past 20 years really, you know, are not necessarily the native dogwood that people grew up with in this area. The native dogwood, Cornus florida, is definitely the one that's, I think, been hit a little bit harder by drought and mildew and anthracnose and all this other stuff. But that's just one dogwood, and there are so many other ones. So can we sort of, you know, highlight, I guess, those main ones that people should pay attention to if they are, in fact, interested in dogwoods?
Sure. Dogwoods run the range. They go from Asia to South America to North America. They're all over the place. And as you said, we know the native flowering dogwood, Cornus florida, with those great big white, four white bracts in the spring. But there are shrub species, the ones with bright red stems and yellow stems, the Cornus ceriseas and Cornus albas, that are fantastic in winter. Of course, if you've got them in your garden right now, the thing you should be doing is whacking them to the ground to generate those nice new bright stems for the for next year, for next winter. But great plants for winter interest. Of course, speaking of bringing spring out of it, out of the depths right now, we've got some flowering right now, Cornus moss, the Cornelian cherry dogwood, which is basically the flower looks like the flower of our native Cornus florida, just that yellowish center. It just doesn't have the big bracts, but very bright yellow.
Okay.
And it's a great one for the spring garden and late winter garden. I mean, this thing, it's blooming now. Mm-hmm. It'll bloom for the next few weeks, and it's a great one for really getting some early color.
Mm-hmm. How about the Asian species?
Well, the Asians, the most common Asian species that's grown is Cornus kusa, which is sort of like the late blooming Cornus florida. It's a little more upright in growth, blooms with the leaves, but it's much more disease resistant. It's not as susceptible to the dogwood anthracnose and the powdery mildews and all those things that drive us crazy about the native flowering dogwood. And in the last 5 years, there's only been about 652 zillion varieties that have been introduced that range from the white bracts to pink to deep reds, even some creamy yellows, variegated forms, weeping forms, columnar forms, forms that say happy birthday. There's just so many of them out there.
Uh-huh. So we'll highlight some of those plants here in a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, before we get into specific plants, let's talk about culture a little bit. I get a lot of questions about where's the best place to put a dogwood, how far from the house, should it get afternoon sun, morning shade? Kind of run down the list of where you think dogwoods ought to be sited.
Really, dogwoods are wonderfully sun tolerant. They're both shade and sun tolerant. The key is just the soil. It's got to be, you've got to have organic matter in it, some nice compost, and just kept well watered and minimally mulched. Mm-hmm. That means no mulch volcanoes. And as long as they have a reasonable root run, they can take a lot of sun, and you'll see them in the wild that way.
So then it's fair to say that the dogwood is not necessarily a tree for everyone, particularly if you do that have that really hostile environment of clay-compacted construction soil.
Yeah, what I always tell people is if you stand at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on August 1st, if you stand in a spot and you don't want to be there,
your
because
dogwood
it's too
doesn't
hot
either.
And nasty, right.
I gotcha.
Dogwood. Well, let's talk some cultivars. Are you giving up entirely on the native, the Cornus florida, or there's some varieties you might recommend for people before we talk about the Asian?
Now, there's some very good. The University of Tennessee actually has released some varieties over the last few years. Appalachian Spring is a variety that came out a number of years ago, and it's not 100% immune to dogwood anthracnose, but it's pretty darn resistant. And then there's the rest of the Appalachian series, which is Appalachian Snow is probably the best of the rest of them, has been selected for mildew resistance. And the distinction between the two, I think, is important. Most of us in the Louisville area have never seen dogwood anthracnose. Right. Dogwood anthracnose is severe in the eastern mountains, especially when you get down into the Carolinas and even in Virginia and areas where you're in those high elevations. You get those sort of cloudy, moist days in the spring, and that's just what dogwood anthracnose needs. Kentucky, it's mildew. I would say any dogwood that's died recently of some disease in the Louisville area, it's most likely been powdery mildew. And so both of those are things to look at.
Okay, how about the Asian dogwoods, the kusas? Talk about those and some of your favorite cultivars.
Well, first thing I always like people to remember is that we don't promote those as a replacement because it's a very different tree. It blooms a month later. It's got a different growth habit, but it's still a fantastic garden plant. And what we like about it is much more disease resistant. It's more resistant to the borer insects that wreak havoc on our natives. And there's just so much variety out there. They're just good, tough plants. What I like is the forms that I always look for the forms that have good foliage. Mm-hmm. And I always look for named cultivars. Cornus kusa If you grow a million seedlings of Cornus cusa, you'll get a few hundred dogs, you'll get a few hundred fabulous plants, and a few hundred in the middle, which is different than Cornus florida. If you grow a million Cornus florida seedlings, you get about 982,000 pretty darn good-looking Cornus floridas. So named forms, if you go with the named selected cultivars, you're more likely to get one that flowers more reliably every year and gives you good characteristics.
So let's take a step back or step in between there somewhere. Because one of my favorite dogwoods that we have out at the farm that Daddy planted is Aurora. And Aurora is a hybrid, right?
Right.
So let's talk about that kind of that hybrid genre of dogwoods.
The sometimes called the Rutgers dogwoods because they were hybridized by Elwin Orton, Dr. Elwin Orton at Rutgers University. And back in the 80s, he introduced these crosses of the Cornus cusa and Cornus florida. And what he was going for was the adaptability of cusa and then the garden worthiness of Cornus florida. And he got some nice combinations. There were six originally introduced, and Aurora that you mentioned is one of the better. Probably Constellation is the other. Really vigorous plants. I mean, you talk about hybrid vigor in seed corn. These things sort of grow through grow through the roof in a hurry. The couple of drawbacks of them, one is that they don't bloom well until they get to be pretty good size. They need to be about 3 to 4 inch diameter trunk before you see much in the way of bloom. The other problem is really more of a cultural problem, and that is when they first came out, the industry sort of promoted them as a replacement for the flowering dogwood. And people planted them, and they were disappointed because they bloom with the leaves like the cusa.
Okay.
So you don't get that early. You don't have the same branching, and you don't have that early bloom on leafless stems that some people equate with our native. But they're tough, tough plants, very durable plants.
Okay. Yeah, my favorite cusa is Wolf Eyes, and I'm sure there are others, but maybe name four or five cusa you'd recommend for this area.
Well, Wolf Eyes is a good variegated one.
Yeah.
It's a great way to brighten up a dark spot in a garden. It's more of a shrubby grower, though not a real tall one. If you wanted a taller, more tree-form variegated form, there's one named Samaritan. That's out there, a little finer textured, but more free-growing and not as shrubby. My favorite of just the straight green leaves and white blooms is one by the name of Green Sleeves, which is just stunning. The foliage is glossy and shiny, even through the late summer and into the fall. Great big, very sort of chalky white blooms and excellent vigor. So that's one of the better. And then one by the name of Blue Shadow. That was named for Don Shadow.
Oh, yeah.
That one's really pretty.
Yeah, it's got a little bit of a blue cast to the foliage, not quite as bold a texture, but just a good overall performer and tough to find anything wrong with it.
Yeah. So you had mentioned that the whole, like, cultivated named varieties of the Cornus cusa. And, you know, I haven't shopped for a traditional Cornus florida dogwood in a really long time, if ever, right? So is there actually a handful of really good cultivated name varieties of Cornus florida for people to look out for as well? Or do we typically just find those as pink flowering and white flowering, you know, seedling grown?
I think the best thing is really those Appalachian series, because those are all just straight Cornus florida.
Okay.
It's just that they've been selected out of seed batches to be, because they were more resistant than others. And so those are really the best, I think. It's pretty risky these days to just go out and buy an unnamed Cornus florida in a pot and stick it in the ground, because chances are the mildew's going to hit it awfully hard, and it's just not going to make a great garden plant.
Okay, let's jump over to red buds. And the first question I have, and this is one I've had for about 1,000 years, is there are no red buds as far as I can tell.
Are you 1,000 years old, Bob?
I always had that question too, Bob.
Why aren't there any red buds? There's all sorts of pinks and whites, but how'd the red bud get this name? Any idea?
I have no clue whatsoever.
No, but this is what we need to do, you all. When the red bud is in a tighter bud form before it's actually popped.
It's purple. The best way to tell whether or not it's
red
is you take a red geranium and you hold it up next to it.
Yeah.
And it's not red.
If your eyes start to bleed, it's not red.
Okay.
It's a bad combination. Red buds are going off the charts. There is so much going on in red buds.
Yeah.
What's interesting is many people know forest pansy, which is sort of that burgundy-leafed form that goes a little muddy late in the summer. Then, of course, Theodore Klein's silver cloud, which is the variegated form. The more recent introduction, Covey or Lavender Twist, which is the weeper. And then more recently, some of the gold ones that have come out in the market. Bright yellow foliage.
That's
all
really
summer.
Not a red bud.
But what's amazing about this is we have just sort of stumbled into some wonderful bit of good fortune in the genetics of these things. Because like Mendel, who was fortunate enough to select P traits that were all controlled by single genes. All these traits in red buds are all single gene traits, and they're all transmissible through seed generation.
Is there too?
And so right now, there's a number of people in the country working on red buds. And basically, if you take weeping, variegated, purple leaves, yellow leaves, and green leaves, basically make any combination you like. Mm-hmm. And in the next few years, those will be out.
So I'm a traditionalist, I think, when it comes to the red bud, and my favorite thus far in terms of like the named cultivars is the Appalachian Red. And is that one from Tennessee, like those other, the dogwoods by any chance, or is that just a name that
That was just a name that somebody found and stuck. But it's an intense color.
It's an extremely intense color.
Screaming pink,
yeah.
Actually.
Yeah. I don't know. It's like, yeah, it's really
just
intense.
Just don't plant it with your pink flowering dogwoods.
I won't.
Because that's a rough combination on any
it
set
is.
Of eyes.
Well, I'm a traditionalist, like I said.
White dogwoods and pink red buds, right?
Yeah.
Paul, what about the culture for the red bud? They seem to me to be a little more of a weaker tree than dogwoods. Maybe that's just my thought on it.
Well, wood-wise.
Well, what you mean in terms of breaking up in the storms?
Right.
Yeah, the storm breakage in dogwoods and redbuds, basically in flowering dogwoods, big old trees that had some weak branch unions sort of fell apart, but younger, healthy trees held up pretty well. Redbuds, you saw there was a lot of sort of twisting damage.
Right.
Generally, they hold up fairly well, but there was some damage on them.
How about the culture? Where would you place a redbud?
Full sun. They want the more sun, the better. The better fall color, the better growth you get. Yep.
Huh.
They're reasonably drought tolerant. Mm-hmm. They certainly are happy to have a little irrigation mm-hmm. through the dry period of the summer.
Sure.
But they're pretty good, pretty durable plants. The main disease problem in red buds is a vascular wilt called verticillium wilt, which mm-hmm. hits maples and smoke trees. But it generally hits stress trees.
Uh-huh.
So if you take reasonable care of your trees, red buds can be a pretty long-lived and happy tree.
Well, Paul, thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Dr. Paul Cappiello is Executive Director of Udell Gardens in Crestwood and co-author of the book Dogwoods. For more information on Udell or Dr. Cappiello, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we've got listeners' questions and another chapter in Bob's Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Good afternoon. This is Janine Wishy here with Bob Hill, co-host.
Yep. Coming up next is us.
Coming up next is us. But we're here today because it's our spring drive, and we're asking you to show your support for WFPL, of course, but also for Homegrown. You can call us at 814-6565 or go online at WFPL.org. We have a $3,000 goal for just this hour, and we need help. And it's the only chance.
Only chance the whole year, twice a year.
Yeah.
We're on one here live to show how much your support is for Homegrown. We need $3,000. And like I said, we help you, you help us.
That's right. And, you know, over the last couple of years, they've shortened the drives. So there's only one Sunday that we're on, you know, during the spring drive. So that's why this is your only opportunity to really show your support specifically of Homegrown. But of course, that, you know, continues to flow and it supports the rest of the programming on WFPL. Homegrown's one of the locally produced shows here straight out of the studios downtown. So if you enjoy the show, if you're getting into gardening, call us at 502-814-6565 or go online at WFPL.org.
We also go out in the community and do show different gardens. We visit gardens and go around Indiana and Kentucky, mm-hmm. just all over the place. And if you have an interesting garden you think it should be in Homegrown, give us a call and we'll come out and we'll do it.
And we've got a couple people from Indiana to thank. From Bloomington, Indiana, Sarah Keeney. She is the president of the Daffodil Society, and she says, happy birthday, Sarah. Let's see. We have an anonymous supporter of Homegrown and WFPL, also from Clarksville, Indiana. So, yeah, we get Southern Indiana people. We've heard from people from all over the place, really. It's pretty cool. So,
and as I've said earlier, I just kind of imagine your week or your life without public radio, without Homegrown, without the many great shows that's put on by public radio. I was in Washington, D.C. a couple weeks ago. My daughter-in-law is a weekend editor for NPR, and I got to visit with Scott Simon and talk to him and go to the mothership. And just from the top on down, it's just such great people. I just enjoy being around them. And
great stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was fun.
Yeah.
I've also got a couple people to thank here.
We're $1,600 left to raise, folks.
We're
halfway there, but we only have 15 more minutes, so give us a call, 814-6565.
We want to thank Mary and Andrew Bryant. They're Renew on behalf of the Chubb Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And then Steve, P-A-C-S-C-H, Renew. Thank you.
Bob has a hard time reading these, you know, pieces of paper.
It's the spelling part.
Yeah. But we do want to thank you as well. We've got $1,600 left to make our $3,000 goal for this hour. Please show your support for Homegrown and WFPL programming by calling us at 502-814-6565. You can give, and, you know, like the $52 level is, what, $1 a week,
Bob? $1 a week, yeah.
You mentioned the day sponsorship, $1 a day at $365. Or you could do $10 a month at $120 pledge. You know, anything that makes sense to you, and, you know, that will allow you to show your support of public radio. Keep us on the air. Keep us strong. We have to make $170,000 this time around. And certainly we want to hit that $3,000 goal for Homegrown this hour. Show us your support. It's the only opportunity for this particular drive to show your support of Homegrown. Call us at 502-814-6565.
Or go online at WFPL.org. Mm-hmm. And you can pledge online, too.
Yeah, you can. And it's all safe and secure. Yeah. You can use a credit card or send a check or drop the cash by any way you want to.
Figure that out.
Yeah.
I feel certain of that.
Yeah.
And, of course, today's a special Sunday incentive. Today you can be registered to win a $750 gift card from Rainbow Blossom Natural Food Markets, mm-hmm. which is where Janine shops most of the time when she's probably
when I'm not harvesting it from. That's right.
Natural food.
And the garden has gone in, Bob. Yep. I've planted chard. I've planted peas. I've planted one variety of Swedish fingerling potatoes and then some other greens and stuff, leeks in the garden. So I am ready to go. I know lots of other people are ready to go. You know, we were talking about how seed sales are up this year. So if you are a supporter of Homegrown and you're one of those that's buying all those seeds, call us at 814-6565. Show your support. But also, here's something funny. We went up to Metzger's to order some chicks.
Oh.
We were going to get three new chicken breeds. But the hatcheries are having a hard time keeping up, too. So chickens are more popular than ever, just like seeds are.
So you've got to listen to Homegrown to do it right.
Give us a call, 814-6565.
$1,600. We need it.
That's right. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Janine Wishy.
This is Bob Hill.
And we have some interesting tree questions.
We do.
This one's from Lisa. Yesterday, I learned that lacebark elm is vulnerable to ice storm damage.
Yeah.
Yeah, mine are too. Yeah. Yep. Our mature elm is living proof of such. Our tree guy consulted an arborist on how to remove the damaged limbs that were there. She says approximately one half of the major limbs had to be removed, Bob. So she's wondering, basically, since so much of the tree has been removed and it's not as pretty as it was before, do we think that, like, the limbs will, like, fill out with residual limbs like an old cherry tree had done once in her experience?
Right.
And I'm inclined to say, Lisa, I don't think so. Not those main branches.
Right.
I mean, if you've got whole holes in the tree, the way that lacebark elms grow, you don't really get like a boxwood where the little hole's going to fill in. So
I don't know. Have to see the tree to make a final decision on this. But I was really kind of discouraged with my lacebark and what happened to it. I mentioned earlier a secondary look at my yard, and I went around behind some trees and saw where limbs had just ripped off the back, and my lacebark's the same way.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to give it a year just because it's in an area that was full shade, and all of a sudden I got a lot of sun to deal with. I want to make the transition for my ground plants easier, but I think I'm going to cut it down.
And Bob, Lisa goes on to say they are planning to watch the elm for 2 years, and if it irreversibly is damaged, then they'll have it removed. And that's, I think, the best really thing to do, don't you?
Yeah.
You know, wait and see. We've got two in front of the house. One of them has a bunch of broken branches in it, but, you know, maybe at most a third of it, maybe 25% of it. It's in a uniform enough sort of way where they can be cleaned up and the tree will maintain a nice shape still. The other tree, half of it got blown out and it's all lopsided and messed up. So there's no point in waiting 2 years because it's never going to look right. So we're going to have that one taken down.
Well, sort of amazing. I lost two monster trees in the front yard is how quickly your mind adapts to the hole in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
You think you'll never get over it,
right?
But you do.
You do.
You go on to other things, and that's
and you plant something new. Opportunity.
That's the way the game works.
That's right. All right. Well, we hope that that helps. Tree questions. Definitely common these days. Yeah.
If you have more questions for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 502-814-8246.
All right, Bob, it's Plant Story Day. What do you have for us?
A wee bit to the Blarney today, lass.
All right.
A little bit of an Irish, little Irish bent to this one, which I love to do this really rotten Irish accent on the air.
In honor of St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, no, it's in honor of Mahonia, believe
okay.
it or not.
Okay.
Mahonia. It's one of my favorite stories I've done so far because it's about a guy whose name should have long lived in horticultural history, and we've forgotten.
But didn't.
Totally forgotten. But first, the plant. Do you grow the Mahonia?
Yes, I love it.
Yeah, it's also called the Oregon grape holly because it was first found during Lewis and Clark in the expedition up in the state of?
Oregon.
You're good. Stick with me, kid. Yeah, it's a big gangly shrub. I have it in the garden. It's not really easy to love, I don't think, but I do, and many visitors do, too. Because it's got these spiny leaves, big bunches of really blue berries that look like grapes, of all things. And the fall colors on the leaves are red and yellow and orange. It's just it's an interesting plant. And in the spring, it's got these bright yellow flowers that I really like. They don't smell real well. You can almost call them stinky, but they're very interesting, and it's a nice plant to have around. There are several cultivars, the Repans, the lower growing one, the Aquifolium, which is the regular Oregon grape holly, and then the Beli, which I have, is a 5 or 6 footer. Just an interesting plant to have. But the really interesting story for me, it was named for a guy named Bernard McMahon, believe it or not. Yeah. He was born in Ireland and came to America in 1796. He settled in Philadelphia and established a seed and nursery business. Very shortly hereafter, he began one of the first export seed businesses in what was then the colonies, I guess. He sent plants back to Europe and the seeds back to Europe. He was acquainted with Thomas Jefferson as well as other distinguished men of the time. It is said the famous Lewis and Clark expedition was planned in his home. He also published in 1806 the first really important horticultural book in the colonies. The name was the American Gardener's Calendar. It was the standard encyclopedia for many years. Never heard of the guy.
I know, me either.
Yeah. So there's a poem about him.
Well, there better be.
There better be. We got to help this guy out a little bit.
Okay.
Let's lift a glass of Guinness for Bernard McMahon, a totally and utterly forgotten man, who moved here from Ireland in 1796 and found our nation in a terrible fix. At least as far as plants were concerned, the country's reputation as yet unearned. So Barnard plowed the path that would succeed. He collected and sold our American seed. A friendship with Europe he soon would forge, not to mention the gardens of old King George. He led our way from the horticultural dark while enlisting the aid of Lewis and Clark. So please remember the man, by gosh and by golly, whenever you see some Oregon grape holly.
Very nice. The Mahonia.
Yeah, Bernard McMahon, Mahonia.
Mahonia. Thank you, Bob. Very good. Okay. Very educational.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, a little trip to the Everglades, perhaps?
Homegrown is produced by the grape product imbibing Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.
Support for WFPL comes from Limewalker Tree Service, local providers of tree care and preservation focused on the science of tree care to add years to mature trees. Certified arborists provide pruning, fertilizing, bracing, disease treatment, and removal services. Limewalker 6340400 or limewalkertree.com. From Udell Gardens, Louisville's Botanical Garden, hosting the 3rd annual Hellebore Days, Saturday the 28th, featuring winter blooming perennials, witch hazels, minor bulbs, and more for winter and early spring gardens. Information at udellgardens.org. From CourierJournal.com's mobile web service, which enables users to get business news, sports scores, and entertainment information wherever and whenever via cell phone. Businesses can use CourierJournal.com's mobile service to send text message alerts to a targeted audience. Details at 582-4734.
Good afternoon. This is Janine Wishy.
This is a really bad poet, Bob Hill.
And we are hosts, co-hosts, partners in crime for Homegrown. This hour, we needed to raise $3,000, and we haven't quite done that yet, folks. We still have about $1,100 to raise.
We need your help.
We do need your help. So call us at 502-814-6565. Show your support for Homegrown. It's your only chance to show your support for Homegrown this drive, because it's just one Sunday for the whole drive. It's right. A shorter drive than the old days. So give us a call, 814-6565. And Bob.
Yes, ma'am.
Somebody loves you. Well, you know I love you, but
yeah, that's just two people.
But your wife loves you too.
She did it again.
She, Janet Hill, from Utica, Indiana.
That's my girl.
She did a day sponsor for you again, babe. And she likes Homegrown. She better. So thank you, Janet, for supporting us.
That's her checkbook, I hope.
Yeah, no kidding. And then also thanks to Nancy Fred. She says, thanks for all you do. And thank you, Nancy.
A Virginia Wishy may sound familiar.
Well, my mama loves
me
too.
Her favorite show is Homegrown. What else? Very timely, she says.
Thank you, Mom.
Someone named Andrew Smart.
My mother and my husband support
loves
Homegrown. So you need to as well.
Particularly loves Bob, he says.
Uh-huh.
And it's a renewing pledge and add to a pledge.
Add
actually.
To pledge, yeah.
Thank you, Andrew
Thanks,
Smart.
Babe.
And then Paige McGuire. Has a Homegrown question, what to do with shredded trees.
Oh, she has a question.
Yeah.
All right, we'll answer her question, but we need to hear from you first. Call us at 502-814-6565. We have not quite met our goal of $3,000 this hour, and we only have a couple of minutes left, so please call or go to our website, wfpl.org, 814-6565. We just had a ton of wood shredded up. And it's dumped in piles back in the garden. And, you know, it's best to have it kind of decomposed just a little bit so it doesn't leach nitrogen out of the soil. But absolutely, it can be used as mulch.
And this is March Homegrown Madness.
We
got to win.
We got to win, man.
We cannot lose.
So give us a call, 814-6565.
This is it.
We've got a third of our goal still to meet and just a couple of minutes left. So I hope that you're talking to our folks back there that are on the phone.
We want to feel the love.
We do want
we
to
love
feel
you.
The love.
We got to feel the love.
That's right. Give us a call, 814-6565, or go to our website at wfpl.org. Our goal for the week is $170,000. But for the hour, just show your support for Homegrown. It was just $3,000, and we still have $1,000 we need to knock out.
$1 a week will do it. $1 a day is Mrs. Robert Hill from Utica, Indiana.
That's right.
Sent in.
Or
that's my girl.
$10 a month.
Yeah.
You know,
whatever works.
Whatever works for you. But we need to hear from you. Show your support, public radio and Homegrown. 502-814-6565.
Imagine life without Homegrown or public radio.
Yeah.
I can't.
I can't either.
No.
Give us a call, 814-6565. 6565.